Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. We have a lot more Virginia ratification debates to go through. Let me also remind you that this show is also sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org as well as RepublicReview.org, as well as the fact that we have a listen line. You do not have to stream. And if you're not in our broadcasting area, dial 605-562-4209 or the other number, 605-313-0599. And so what we want to do is we kind of want to get through get into the ratification debates as early as we possibly can, instead of going through all the obligatory stuff. You know, we need your help. Info@reclaimingtherepublic.org is the best way to get a hold of us, or you can call 425-270-5416. And that way you can leave a comment, especially if you're trying that Red State coffee, because we'd love to hear your comments on that. In addition, we are looking for you to step up. What we want to do is go through these ratification debates so you can hear for yourself exactly what the framers said. And these ratification debates actually has Madison. We've read Mason already, and Nicholas, and so forth. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to put aside, you know, all of the news that's not going anywhere. They're going to be doing discovery on shootings. They're going to be doing discovery on assassination attempts and a plethora of things that could easily get you sucked in to go, oh my gosh, is this really happening? Yeah, a lot of things are happening, and the reason we are so off kilter is because the federal government is no longer abiding by the Constitution. And so we're going to prove that. We've been proving that this last week and this week, and maybe going into next week. I do need to get into the New York ratification debates, and we're going to kind of lightly go through those because there was not a lot of substance in those. Even though Hamilton wasted a lot of oxygen, he babbled. He just went into theory and philosophical thought and so forth. And I'm going, what a waste. He was wasting time deliberately because he was waiting for Virginia to ratify, because he knew as soon as Virginia ratified, it was a done deal. New York would have to ratify because they did not want to be left out. The other thing I want to point out real quick, is the fact that thank you for listening. Those of you who are listening, we would like you, we just request, one way you can help is getting other people to start understanding this message. The best way you can do that is get them to start tuning in, dialing up, and listening to this content. That way they can start understanding that we're pretty myopic here. We're very focused on compliance to the Constitution. You want to solve these problems? You want to solve education? You want to solve abortion? You want to solve health care? Do you want to solve immigration? If you want to solve the problems, the only path in solving the problems is compliance, because the real problem is non-compliance of the Constitution in every direction. So let me kind of dive right into what Mr. Nicholas gets into. And so Mr. Nicholas says this, in answer to the two gentlemen last up, observed that though there was a Declaration of Rights in the government of Virginia, it was no conclusive reason that there should be one in this Constitution. For if it was unnecessary in the former, its omission in the latter could be no defect. They ought, therefore, to prove that it was essential, necessary to be inserted into the Constitution of Virginia. There were 5 or 6 states in the Union which had no Bill of Rights. So there you go. You got the facts. I think last show I said that there was at least one was Virginia. So there's 5 or 6 states that do not have any Bill of Rights. And so it's very important to understand this, because the huge argument that the Anti-Federalists had everything to do with they wanting a Bill of Rights. And there was nothing that stated, oh, well, this is a living document. This is, you know, an open document in Constitution with general powers that let the Supreme Court with all sorts of interpretations. There is, and the Anti-Federalists might have said that, but there is no evidence of them saying that. But the fact of the matter is that what we have is we have all the evidence necessary to prove that the Constitution was limited and defined. If you understand what I'm saying, it was enumerated, limited, defined. There was no ambiguity. There was no living document and so forth. And so let me get back to this. There were five or six states in the Union which had no Bill of Rights separately and distinctly as such, but they annexed the substance of a Bill of Rights to their respective constitutions. These states, he further observed, were as free as the state and their liberties as secure as ours. If so, gentlemen's argument from the precedent were not good. In Virginia, all powers were given to the government without any exception. So what he just basically threw on the table was Virginia had a general powers type of constitution where they were actually fully vested with every power over the people. Very dangerous. It was different in the general government, to which certain special powers were delegated for certain purposes. He asked, which was the more safe? That's how he says it. Was it safer to grant general powers than certain limited powers? This much as to the theory, continued he. What is the practice of this invaluable government? Have your citizens been bound by it? They have not, sir. You have violated the maxim that no man shall be condemned without a fair trial, that that man who was killed not secundum artem was deprived of his life without the benefit of law and in express violation of this Declaration of Rights, which they confided in so much. But, sir, this Bill of Rights was no security. It is but a paper check. It has been violated in many other instances. So he's calling out the dirty laundry for Virginia and how they have been violating their Bill of Rights. Therefore, from the theory and practice, it may be concluded that this government with special powers without any express exceptions is better than a government with general powers and special exceptions. But the practice of England is against us. The rights are reserved to the people, are to limit and check the king's prerogative. It is easier to enumerate the exceptions to his prerogative than to mention all the cases to which it extends. Besides these reservations being only formed in acts of the legislature, may be altered by the representatives of the people when they think proper, or basically pass an amendment. No comparison can be made of this with the other governments he mentioned. There is no stipulation between the king and people. The former is possessed of absolute unlimited authority. And so, obviously, Nichols, he really puts them in their place. First off, he points out that there were so few states that actually had them, and the fact that Virginia had a general type of constitution giving them general powers, and that they have been violating their Bill of Rights, and this is where I say this, and I've said this before. I believe the Bill of Rights probably did more damage out the gate than they helped. Down the road, when after the Civil War, when they passed the 14th Amendment, the Bill of Rights actually helped, because it was the Bill of Rights that helped protect the freemen from oppression and should have been protecting them from Jim Crow laws and all the rest of these things. But the problem was that the bench with Taney and a lot of them started actually legislating and using agendas to move things forward, to maintain racism and so forth. I keep on saying this, that the Constitution itself does not possess racism. It is how it has been perverted and applied by subversive minds that has created acts of racism and those types of things. And so let me let me just kind of dive forward because we still got that clock ticking and Mr. Madison is up on deck. And what he says is this: Mr. Madison was surprised that any gentleman should return to the clauses which had already been discussed. He begged the gentleman to read the clauses which gave the power of exclusive legislation, and he might see that nothing could be done without the consent of the states with respect to the supposed operation of what was denominated the sweeping clause, what they call the sweeping clause. The gentleman, he said, was mistaken, for it only extended to the enumerated powers. Should Congress attempt to extend any power not enumerated, it would not be warranted by the clause. As to the restriction in the clause under consideration, it was a restraint on the exercise of a power expressly delegated to Congress, namely that of regulating commerce with foreign nations. So this is a little piece of gold, because you have to understand that Congress and the federal government said we can regulate commerce for everybody, but actually the regulating of commerce with foreign nations. So if you're making products and you're exporting it, then the federal government has regulations, or they have the power to regulate that, whether they want to put duties on it or what have you, because they do have those powers. The Constitution has granted them those types of powers. So with this concept, and actually we're 10 seconds out, so I'm just going to kind of let us go into this next break. But I am here to tell you that if you read what Madison just said, that is a piece of gold, because it closes down the Commerce Clause, because the Commerce Clause was considered a sweeping clause that allowed Congress and the federal government to come in and actually regulate your wheat and everything else, when even if you weren't exporting it. They only have the power for exchange between the states and foreign nations, and for the regulation or the evenly flowing of commerce between the states. But we'll be right back after this. Thank you so much. Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Moby Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Moby Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Okay, so the number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK or 215-867-8255. Do not forget my three C's when you dial in. And let's get on with the dialogue.
And so the next one is actually a comment by George Nicholas regarding slavery. And he was kind of wondering, and this is the the dialogue of the scribes, because they were kind of capturing the expressions and so forth instead of actually trying to capture every word. And so he says, Mr. Nicholas, or the scribe wrote, Mr. Nicholas wondered that gentlemen who were against slavery should be opposed to this clause, as after that period, the slave trade would be done away. He asked if gentlemen did not see the inconsistency of their arguments. They object, says he, to the Constitution because the slave trade is laid open for 20 years. And yet they tell you that by some latent operation of it, the slaves who are now will be manumitted at the same moment it is opposed for being promotive and destructive of slavery. He contended that it was advantageous to Virginia that it should be in the power of Congress to prevent the importation of slaves after 20 years, as it would put a period to the evil, or put an end, actually, is I think what he meant, to the evil complained of. Now, one of the things that I think is kind of important to throw in here is the fact that there were a lot of shenanigans in Congress as the slave trade was being shut down and so forth. And it didn't take long for the Democrats, Martin Van Buren, to put a gag order on discussing slavery, because they were moving forward in trying to actually change the perception of the Constitution, not the actual Constitution. And what the Missouri Compromise did was it actually violated the Constitution, because the Constitution has no standing in dictating a state whether it's going to be a slave state or a free state. And when Congress basically came in, it was a political compromise with those slave state brothers. And so they were making deals with the devil. And that's precisely who these Democrats were operating as most people know. I mean, the Ku Klux Klan came from that organization as well, from the Democratic Party. Anyway, Nicholas also says this, let me say that in my opinion, the adversaries of the Constitution wander equally from the true meaning. It would not fatigue the House too far. I would go back to the question of reserved rights. The gentleman supposes that complete and unlimited legislation is vested in the Congress of the United States. This has been proven wrong over and over again. I'm just inserting that. This supposition, this is George Nicholas again, this supposition is founded on false reasoning. What is the present situation of this state? She has possession of all rights of sovereignty except those given to the Confederation. She must delegate power to the Confederate government. It is necessary for her public happiness. Her weakness compels her to confederate with the 12 other governments. She trusts certain powers to the general government in order to support, protect, and defend the Union. Now, is there not a demonstrable difference between the principle of the state government and the general government? There is not a word said in the state government of the powers given to it, because they are general. But in the general constitution, its powers are when he says the general constitution, he's talking about this general government, or for the federal government's constitution, its powers are enumerated. It is not then fairly deducible that it has no power but what is expressly given it. For if its powers were to be general, an enumeration would be needless. And so there he goes, and I think goes right back into their face and says, look, you guys keep going down the same path of saying the same thing. So here's the thing. As I have said this back and forth, when the Federalists were asserting one thing, saying that there's general powers there, that they have this exclusive, and they say, no, it's not, by the fact that they ratified and accepted those terms from Nicholas, from Madison, and all these people saying, no, it's not, those were the terms that were accepted into it. Had a state outright rejected and failed to ratify because they believed the Federalists, or the anti-Federalist argument, then it would have been a different story. There wasn't one state that failed to ratify. There wasn't one state that rejected it. There was some states that, you know, refused to look at it. Rhode Island didn't even look at it until after everybody else was in. They go, I guess we better do something about this. And they did. South Carolina, North Carolina. North Carolina went through the ratification process, but they failed to actually take a vote. They did not reject it. They actually just suspended. And that was a big mistake. And they recognized that that was a huge mistake. They could have actually ratified before New York would have ratified, I believe. Anyway, let me move further. And this is Mr. Pendleton. But it is represented to be consolidated and to be a consolidated government, annihilating that of the states. Now, he's just saying that this is what these people are saying. A consolidated government, which so extensive a territory as the United States cannot admit of without terminating its despotism. If this be such a government, I will confess with my worthy friend that it is inadmissible over such a territory as this country. Let us consider whether it be such a government or not. I should understand a consolidated government to be that which should have the sole and exclusive power of legislative, executive, and judicial powers without any limitation. Is this such a government, or can it be changed to such a one? It only extends to the general purposes of the Union. It does not intermeddle with the local particular affairs of the states. Can Congress legislate for the state of Virginia? Can they make a law altering the form of transferring property or the rule of descendants in Virginia? In one word, can they make a single law for the individual exclusive purpose of any one state? It is the interest of the federal to preserve the state governments. Upon the latter, the existence of the former depends. The state derives its existence immediately from the state legislators, and the representatives and the president are elected under their direction and control. They also preserve order among the citizens of their respective states, and without order and peace, no society can possibly exist. Unless, therefore, there be state legislatures to continue the existence of Congress, I preserve order and peace among the inhabitants, this general government, which gentlemen suppose will annihilate the state government, must itself be destroyed. When, therefore, the federal government is, in so many respects, so absolutely dependent on the states, I wonder how any gentleman reflecting on the subject could have conceived an idea of a possibility of the former destroying the latter. But the power of laying direct taxes is objected to. Government must be supported. This cannot be done without a revenue. A sufficient revenue be not otherwise raised. Recurrence must be had to direct taxation. Gentlemen admit this, but insist on the propriety of first applying to the state legislatures. And so it kind of went around about, and there were a lot of conversations regarding direct tax. And I've mentioned this before, and a lot of people don't know this, but Hamilton, one of the ways Hamilton was proposing to settle the debt because of this ability to direct tax, the federal government was going to actually put a tax on the sale of horses. And it was perceived as a non-uniform type of law. In other words, that law would have been more applicable to the southern states than the northern states, because it was far more agrarian, where horses were integral in, you know, the plantations, the agriculture, and everything else. But up in Boston, and, you know, there weren't very many horses in New York and so forth. I mean, they were, but not to the extent of down in the South. And they looked at that as an onerous type of an application of law, because it would not have been uniform amongst all of the states. Some states would have been paying more for the debt than other states would have been. And so it was killed, but still, the concept was they weren't fighting the idea that you can't direct tax horses. they were fighting the idea that it was not uniform, that the southern states would actually be paying a larger extent. And Hamilton knew this, and so they got him on the constitutionality. But if it would have been unconstitutional for them to direct tax, then they would have said, oh, well, oh, you know, we can't argue that, because it was very clear. And you, if you read through these debates, that's precisely what they stated. Even James Monroe got into a good back and forth with Madison in the Virginia ratification debates regarding direct taxation, and felt that it was an evil. But Madison kept on saying it's necessary. We have to have money to function, to be able to do the things and exercise the powers that we're supposed to have this military, to have security, to, you know, operate exchanges, or actually the importation of goods and so forth. And so it was heavily debated. But the bottom line is, it was accepted, because how the Federalists described it, that's how it was embraced. And so down the road, they started veering away from that and started making it a little harder. The states kind of created some wedges. But that's down the road. What we want to focus on is how they actually defined this Constitution. So we'll be right back with Mr. Nicholas after this. Thank you so much. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
So Mr. Nicholas is up and he is about to unleash again. And I actually grew very fond of the way he articulated his argument, especially his speech. Mr. Pendleton, yeah, a little bit more difficult. It's difficult to read because it just doesn't come out right. Anyway, Mr. Nicholas says this: Mr. Chairman, if the resolution taken by the House is going regularly through the system, clause by clause, had been followed, I should confine myself to one particular paragraph. But as to my surprise, the debates have taken a different turn. I shall endeavor to go through the principal parts of the argument made use of by the gentleman in opposition to the proposed plan of government. The worthy gentleman entertained us very largely on the impropriety and dangers of the powers given by this plan to the general government. But his argument appears to be, to me, inconclusive and inaccurate. It amounts to this: that the powers given to any government ought to be small. I believe this, sir. I believe this, sir, is a new idea in politics. Powers being given for some certain purpose ought to be proportionate to that purpose, or else the end for which they are delegated will not be answered. It is necessary to give powers to a certain extent to any government. If a due medium is not observed in the delegation of such powers, one of two things must happen. If they be small, the government must molder and decay away. If too extensive, the people must be oppressed. As there can be no liberty without government, it must be as dangerous to make powers too limited as too great. He tells us that the Constitution annihilates the Confederation. Did he not prove that every people had a right to change their government when it should be deemed inadequate to their happiness? The Confederation, being found utterly defective, will he deny our right to alter or abolish it? But he objects to the expression, "we the people," and demands the reason why they had not said, "we the United States of America." In my opinion, the expression is highly proper. It is submitted to the people, because on them it is to operate till adopted, but it is but a dead letter. So in other words, that's why they called it "we the people." That was the style change, because it was for them that it was to operate. And until it was adopted, it was a dead letter. Anyway, moving on. "And not binding on any one. When adopted, it becomes binding on the people who adopt it. It is proper on another account. We are under great obligations of the Federal Convention for recurring to the people, the source of all power. The gentleman's argument militates against itself. He says that the person in power never relinquish their powers willingly. If then the state legislators would not relinquish their part of the powers they now possess to enable the general government to support the Union, reference to the people is necessary." Because why? Who elects these people? The people do. In other words, the legislatures are elected by the people themselves. Anyway, this next one is also Mr. Nicholas, and he says, "But it is complained that they may suspend our laws. The suspension of the writ of habeas corpus is only taken place in cases of rebellion or invasion." Note, this is a gold nugget. So I'm going to highlight this because I want to provide this to you. Why is this so important? That the suspension of habeas corpus is only taken place in cases of rebellion or invasion. This is necessary in those cases. In other cases, Congress itself is restrained from suspending it. In no other case can they suspend our laws, and this is a most estimable security. But the influence of England and the northern states has dreaded there are apprehensions of their combining against us. Not to advert to the improbability and illiberty of this idea, it must be supposed that our population will, in a short period, exceed theirs, as their country is well settled, and we have very extensive uncultivated tracts. We shall soon outnumber them as great a degree as they do us at this time. Therefore, this government, which I trust, and actually by that point in time, because I think in the census, Virginia became the most populated state, and they were only a year or two away from that. But anyway, we shall soon outnumber them in a great degree as they do us at this time. Therefore, this government, which I trust, will last to the remote ages, will be very shortly in our favor. Treason consists in levying war against the United States or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. The punishment of this well-defined crime is to be declared by Congress. No oppression, therefore, can arise on this ground. This needs to be gone through again because you have to understand what they're talking about of suspending habeas corpus. This is where they're calling for martial law, and that is when there is rebellion or invasion. Is Antifa in the streets of Portland rebellious behavior and violating the laws? Absolutely. Should the state call in the militia? Now, if it was at a grander scale than the federal government, you know, if it was across different states, let's say the Antifa decided to conduct an operation which, you know, attacked several cities in several different states. The militia should be responding to all, and then the federal government should and could call up the militia to actually suspend habeas corpus and go after all of these Antifa dolts, have them arrested and dragged in. That was the whole point of this, my friends. But it was going to be the militia, not some foreign kid that, you know, grew up in a completely different part of the world and, you know, somehow got slid into a billet in the military because, you know, he's, you know, willing to serve the country for his citizenship because they were doing that. Or somebody coming into your state from another state, from far off, not knowing you, your culture. That's why we had a militia. That's why this responsibility was very specifically delegated to the militia. Do you understand? It was genius the way they did this. And anybody that tells you that anybody has a right to actually protest and violate the laws, when you start violating law, and you start taking away the rights of others because you shut down their ability to flow commerce or what have you, that's violating a law, then you're in rebellion. That's not a protest anymore. Your protest is going down to City Hall and or whatever government you have your grievances and addressing your grievances with them. That is your constitutional right. Okay, so anyway, going on, he says, the punishment of this well-defined crime is to be declared by Congress. No oppression, therefore, can arise on this ground. This security does away the objection that the most grievous oppressions might happen under color of punishing crimes against the general government. The limitation of the forfeiture to life of the criminal is also an additional privilege. And so, let me just kind of move on with the next piece. And guess who it is? It's Mr. Nicholas again. And Mr. Nicholas says this, another argument against this disingenuous construction is drawn from the clause which regulates representation, which is conclusive from the words themselves. Representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union according to the respective numbers. Each state will know from its population its proportion of any general tax, as it was justly observed by the gentleman over the way. And see, this goes down to that same thing I was telling you about Hamilton and taxing horses. Mr. Randolph, this is the gentleman down the way, they cannot possibly exceed that proportion. They are limited and restrained expressly to it. The state legislatures have no check of this kind. Their power is uncontrolled. This excludes the danger of interference. Each collects its own taxes and bears its own deficiencies, and officers are accountable to each government for the different collections. Okay? And so, this is all just fascinating stuff, and I know some of this stuff I've never covered before, so this is the first time you've heard some of these things, especially these arguments regarding the direct tax and so forth. I may have commented on them before, but I'm here to tell you that these are really important because if you understand the importance of uniformity, if you understand the importance that, you know, any idiot that goes out and says taxation is theft, any taxation is theft is an idiot, because it does not fall within the Adam Smith and the standards of government. We have to have government. We have delegated very specific powers. What we have to do is we have to keep them within those specific powers. Anybody that argues for the doing away with tax and doing away with government is strictly an anarchist and actually a tool for communists, because that's another process and way the communists have taken over, by using anarchists. So anyway, we will be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our Republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255. Okay, so now we're back with Mr. Pendleton. And some of his vernacular, some of the way he speaks is a little bit cumbersome for me. But we will move forward with what he has to say here. But we are told that there will be a war between the two bodies equally, our representatives, and that the state government will be destroyed and consolidated into the general government. I stated before that this could not be so. The two governments act in different manners and for different purposes. The general government in great national concerns in which we are interested in common with other members of the union. The state legislatures in out mere local concerns. Is it true or merely imaginary that the state legislatures will be confined to the care of bridges and roads? I think that, and as a matter of fact, the federal government is taking that over, by the way, and that's unconstitutional. But I think that they are still possessed of the highest powers. They are, my friends. They've been under this spell for a long time, being told, oh, you don't have the power to do this. We tell you what to do. And then they go off singing that song, we do what we're told. Anyway, our dearest rights, life, liberty, and property, as Virginians, are still in the hands of our state legislators. If they prove too feeble to protect us, we resort to the aid of the general government for security. The true distinction is that the two governments are established for different purposes and act on different objects. So that notwithstanding what the worthy gentleman said, I believe I am still correct and insist that if each power is confined within its proper bounds and to its proper objects, an interference can never happen, being for two different purposes as long as they are limited to the different objects. They can no more clash than two parallel lines can meet. Now, one of those things was commerce, when the Wicker v. Filburn, when the federal government started taxing farmers for growing wheat, even if they were just consuming it for themselves, if they were putting it into the trade. Now, see what happened. The federal government created the Department of Agriculture, and they created this consolidation of how, you know, grain would be sold and managed, and everybody just kind of brought it in, and you got paid what the going rate was. So based on, you know, the old market forces, right, supply and demand would dictate how much you got paid. Then government started using shenanigans to the, you know, because farmers were complaining they wanted to get greased. And so what ended up happening was the federal government started subsidizing farmers for not growing to help keep the price up. And I'm going, you got to be kidding me. Why would we do that? Anyway, let me move on. Both lay taxes, but for different purposes. The same officers may be used by both governments, which will prevent a number of inconveniences if an invasion or insurrection or other misfortune should make it necessary for the general government to interpose. This will be for the general purpose of the Union and for the manifest interest of the states. And so the thing that he's talking about with the same officers, he's actually talking about the militia. And so that right there is an application of that, because when it comes down to state legislatures and so forth, that is, those are different. And I think it was Henry that made it impossible for you to hold any other position. If you held a federal position, you could not hold a state position. And there was reasons for that. Mr. Mason pipes up, and I've got to remember, you got to caveat this one comment. I liked George, but he is an anti-federalist. So what he says does not hold water because what he says has been rejected, okay? Mr. Chairman, I'll bet you this has something to do with the Bill of Rights. Mr. Chairman, unless there be some restriction on the power of calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions, we may very easily see that it will produce dreadful oppressions. It is extremely unsafe without some alterations. It should be to use the militia to a very bad purpose. If any disturbance happened in New England or in New Hampshire, to call them from Georgia, this would harass the people so much that they would agree to abolish the use of a militia and establish a standing army. Be very clear. One of the things he's given us here, folks, is the fact that there is no standing army within the Constitution, that the federal government is to use the militia alone for national defense, for going after invasions, for like what's going on with Mexico, what's going on with Antifa, and those types of things, and even enforcing laws such as the, let's say we amended the Constitution and created the Department of Forestry. It would be the militia that would be used to enforce those laws, not a forestry department, because that was the role of the militia, is to enforce all federal law. We would have gone down this point to where the militia would no longer have been voluntary, that the militia would have been paid by both the state and by the federal government. And what would happen and what would be the result of it is probably more and more of the, if we amended the Constitution to the degree that it is today, then the militia would be doing everything from IRS, BLM, ATF, forestry, and all of that type of stuff. So anyway, let me move on to what Mr. Mason is saying. It is extremely unsafe without some alterations. It would be to use the militia in a very bad purpose and to say, okay, I already said that. This would harass the people so much that they would agree to abolish the use of the militia and the standing army. I conceive the general government ought to have power over the militia, but it ought to have some bounds. If gentlemen say the militia of a neighboring state is not sufficient, the government ought to have the power to call forth those other states. The most convenient and contiguous, but in this case, the consent of the state legislatures ought to be had. On real emergencies, this consent will never be denied. Each state being concerned in the safety of the rest, this power may be restricted without any danger. I wish such an amendment as this, that the militia of any state should not be marched beyond the limits of the adjoining states, and if it be necessary to draw them from one end to the continent to the other, I wish such a check as the consent of the state legislatures be provided. Gentlemen may say that this would impede the government and that the state legislators would counteract it by refusing their consent. This argument may be applied to all objections whatsoever. And so he really pushes, and I understand what he was trying to do, but the fact is, this amendment was never made to the Bill of Rights. Wasn't made. And so it's done. It's dead. It's DOA, dead on arrival. And so this next one is Mr. Madison. The honorable member is under another mistake. He wishes martial law to be exercised only in the time of war under an idea that Congress can establish it in peacetime, in time of peace. The states are to have the authority of training the militia according to the congressional discipline and of governing them at all times when not in the service of the Union. Congress is to govern such part of them as may be employed in the actual service of the United States, and such part only can be subject to martial law. Do you get that? In other words, the militia has to be called if they're going to call martial law. The gentlemen in opposition have drawn a most tremendous picture of the Constitution in this respect without considering that the power was absolutely indispensable, that they have alarmed us with the possible abuse of it, but have shown no inducement or motive to tempt them to such abuse. Would the legislator of the state drag the militia of the eastern shore to the western frontiers, or those of the western frontiers to the eastern shore? If the local militia were sufficient to effect the intended purpose, there is something so preposterous and so full of mischief in the idea of dragging militia unnecessarily from one end of the continent to the others that I think that there would be no ground of apprehension. If you limit their power over the militia, you give them a pretext for substituting a standing army. So Madison's kind of agreeing on this. If you put it in the power of the state governments to refuse the militia by requiring their consent, you destroy the general government and sacrifice particular states. The same principles and motives which produce disobedience to requisitions will produce refusals in this case. Now, keep in mind, this is very, very important. Keep in mind, there were no amendments to pull back the militia, to create any restrictions or what have you. The fact of the matter is when they, you know, bought the car and put the keys in it and started driving it around, the first thing they started ignoring, or one of the first things, was the militia. They stopped creating standards. They stopped growing it. They stopped equipping and training. And what ended up happening with the Civil War was that the militia was inept. It was just like the Confederacy was inept. And so they violated the Constitution in fighting that war with a standing army. I am G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. We'll be back again in our next episode with more Virginia ratification debates. The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty.